Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, KBOO.FM on the web. I'm Joe Clement, your host today. The Old Mole is a political magazine from a socialist, feminist, intersectional, radical, abolish the system perspective. We bring you interviews, reviews, analysis, poetry, and other things to shift your consciousness, educate you, agitate you, and put you in connection with what's going to make this world a better place. We emphasize democratic movements from below, though we recognize that taking over or at least addressing state power is in our near future if we want to have a future. And that's why on today's show, we're going to start out with Bill Resnick, who is talking with Sam Jindin about United Auto Workers and recent deals in GM and GM's plans to close plants in Oshawa and the opportunities that we have to take over these large corporations that have developed this infrastructure for making things and making the things that we need, the kinds of transit systems that we're going to need for the future, replacing the car system that GM helped to build, and other things, creating important jobs that are going to help those workers transition from those destructive industries, but also just start to move our material culture in a sustainable direction. Bookmole Larry Bolden is going to be reviewing Kirsty Manning's new novel, The Song of the Jade Lily. And to wrap up today's show, I talk with Ronald Purser about his new book, McMindfulness. Just released last year, McMindfulness critically examines the modern mindfulness movement against the backdrop of neoliberalism and argues it's become a new capitalist spirituality. Going beyond criticism, though, McMindfulness also advocates for reconnecting collective with individual liberation in the teaching and practice of mindfulness. You can find The Old Mole on Twitter or Facebook by just looking up The Old Mole Variety Hour. You can email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. And you can find today's show and all the segments you hear on it in a couple days at kboo.fm/oldmole. You can find past shows, and we post the segments with tidbits and any other kinds of things we make important reference to. Now we're going to turn it over to Bill Resnick and Sam Jindin to talk about UAW, GM, and the future of our economy.
Hi, Sam Jindin. Welcome to KBOO. Sam Jindin was research director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union for 26 years. He writes a lot, co-author with Leo Banich, The Making of Global Capitalism. He also writes op-eds, policy and strategy articles, consults with unions in their struggles. You can find a lot of his work on the website Socialist Project, The Bullet. Recently, he's been examining the struggle in Oshawa, Canada. Oshawa is 60 miles from Toronto, both on Lake Ontario. It's sort of an industrial suburb where General Motors just fired its last 5,000 workers. At its peak, it had 23,000. In his writing about Oshawa, Sam Jindin's major concern is not that auto production there has ended. His concern is that GM is leaving thousands of highly skilled, productive workers and their families without jobs and income. And it's also leaving a completely up-to-date set of factories and expensive transportation and other infrastructure. It's a huge industrial complex, an industrial complex that could, with its highly skilled and motivated labor force, could in a short time be converted to produce what we really need: wind turbines, storage batteries, electric vehicles of every type, farming equipment for regenerative agriculture. If you believe the climate scientists, we'd need them quickly to stop global warming. So, Sam, tell us about Oshawa, General Motors, their plans, the union, the struggle, and then we can get into the struggle to convert the Oshawa complex to make the things we really need.
Okay. Oshawa was, not too long ago, the largest auto complex in America. It had three assembly plants, it had battery plants, it had all kinds of internal component plants, radio plants, etc. And like the auto industry generally in North America, the number of jobs have constantly fallen. There's probably 450,000 or so at the end of the 70s. UAW and CAW GM workers, that's down to 50 to 60,000 now. So, you know, almost 90% of the jobs have gone. And the catch has been that in every round of negotiations, the company promised jobs if the workers would make concessions. That just kept repeating itself, and the jobs kept falling. So that's the tragedy of there not being an adequate union response as it just kind of managed the downscaling of the workforce. And to have a union response, it requires a number of things. One is it's time to think beyond GM. GM is not going to solve this problem, and trying to be militant in bargaining, you can fight for all kinds of things, but jobs isn't one of them. Jobs is something that's larger and political, and to just feign militancy gets you into the trap of sounding militant and then making a concession to get the jobs. You're arguing on the company's terms. That's one point. The second point is somehow we have to deal with the larger question of economic restructuring, because the system as it is isn't working for working people. They're not getting either the security or the decent wages. So that's another major problem. How do you deal with economic restructuring generally, not just General Motors? And I guess the third question is what you're getting at. If you're going to do something that's radical and political, you need to have the public with you. And you can't have the public with you unless you're making demands that aren't just for yourself, but that plug into something that's socially crucial. And the obvious thing there is to address the environment. So the question is, can you put all these things together? The question of the corporations not going to solve our problems, the question of dealing with restructuring and not leaving that just to competitive forces and globalization, and the question of addressing the environment. And all this is wrapped up into unions becoming something other than they've been, because they've just been staggered and reeling and disoriented with lower expectations, and they're really in trouble in the private sector. So they really have to rethink what they are, and that also means rethinking what kind of a vision you have and the question of politics that goes with it.
Oshawa is a completely modern industrial complex with all the infrastructure that's required, the transportation, the electricity. And General Motors is walking away, perhaps to sell some of the equipment to other auto firms. But you have a plan B, not plan A, just to try and eke out a few jobs that then get eliminated in a couple of years. Tell us about plan B and what really should happen.
Plan B involves thinking big. It means stopping to just think going to negotiate your way out of this problem with General Motors. That was never true, and just empirically, it's been a failure. So we need to think bigger, and we need to think of something else. And the obvious thing to think about is, if General Motors doesn't want it, why don't we take it and put it under public ownership and talk about converting, you know, taking all these skills that the workers have, taking this really large facility, taking the equipment that's there, the assembly operations, the paint shop, the stamping facility, coordinating it with nearby components plants. And components plants are usually quite flexible. They can make other things. It doesn't just have to be plugged into the auto industry. And think about what we can do. And the obvious thing is to start planning for doing something around the environment. And one of the things that we've been talking about there with workers is moving to electric vehicles. And crucial to thinking about this is we don't want to get into a position of we convert to something and then we compete with the world and then have to worry about standards in China or Mexico or even in the southern United States that are going to undermine us. So we've argued very much that you have to link this to some kind of planning. It has to involve the state being much more aggressive about improving environmental standards, so it's forcing people to move away from the carbon economy, and also using the state, because there's a lot of vehicles that the state buys. Public transit is obviously critical. We don't just want to move to more cars, but we have all kinds of vehicles for the post office, for hydro, that are going to continue to exist, and we want the government to have a plan to expand the number of those, convert them to electric vehicles, and that would be a base for converting Ottawa to electric vehicles. And it could go along with doing all kinds of things related to the environment that you mentioned earlier in terms of wind turbines and refurbishing of homes, offices. Because, I mean, the reality is, if we're serious about the environment, everything about what we make, how we live, work, wherever we work, offices, how we play, everything, travel, everything is going to have to be changed. So if it's going to have to be changed, why don't we start talking about it? And eventually the car companies themselves will be moving to electrical vehicles, but they're doing everything they can to delay that because they're making a lot of money on the existing cars, so they're not in a hurry to do that. And when they do get around to doing it, it's not likely that they're going to do it in places like Oshawa because they have cheaper places that they could do it. So we need to think about democratic planning. We have to ask this question of why do we leave the future, especially when the future is so dangerous in terms of the environment, to these private corporations. That's not democratic. You can't have a democratic society if those key decisions are made by private companies. And why don't we start talking about creating a capacity to do this kind of conversion? We should, in every community, have some kind of a research center that's examining what capacities we have, what skills we have, what equipment, and what do we need to think about? Hire hundreds of young engineers to start thinking about what we're going to need and how we can convert these things. And that has to be linked to creating the demand for them. If the state isn't ready to create a demand for these by raising standards and forcing some kind of restructuring, it wouldn't work either. So all of this has to come together. You know, a certain kind of decentralization, a certain kind of planning, absolutely taking on private power. And one of the things I'd really emphasize is the environmental movement has done a terrific job of getting the environment on the agenda. But it's done it by being quite general and abstract in a way that most people can agree. Green New Deal sounds good. People argue about should we spend a trillion, should we spend 1.2 trillion. It doesn't mean anything to workers. For a worker to hear that they're promising you a just transition when you don't control anything, they don't believe it. They just know that they're going to lose their job. And what is this just transition? The whole point about ecology is that everything's interrelated. The environment is a major emerging and present crisis. If we're going to do anything about it, it's so big that it requires planning. It can't just be left to markets and fragmented profitability. So it means planning. And we have to say that explicitly. And if you want to plan, you have to control what you're planning. So we have to talk about changing property relations in terms of production. And that's the kind of discussion that has to take place. And then the environmental movement can't just see this as moral lecturing. It has to engage workers in struggle. And there's plants closing everywhere. And if there actually was a political intervention by, for example, the Democratic Socialists of America, other lefties, to wherever this is happening, to start raising the question of conversion and putting that conversion into a larger plan, then you'd be engaging workers. You'd be talking about the direct lives, and you'd be offering something that is very hard. You have to organize. We don't have the base for it yet. But it's something that's possible as an answer. That's what the challenge is.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Canadian Sam Gindin, co-wrote the book, The Making of Global Capitalism. He also writes on working class struggles, union struggles, particularly in the auto industry. We've been talking about how General Motors has just closed down its once biggest auto complex. It was in Oshawa, Canada. Sam, that sounds great. The conservatives, of course, the powers that be, that whole conservative establishment, and of course even most politicians, will say, how can you even talk about that? The state is so inefficient, it's so corrupt. How can it do planning? We have to work with market forces and allow the people to vote through the market. Has high priests who say that, economists, historians, they're completely wedded to this sort of capitalist mythology of the failures of the state. We have to tell a different story.
But we have to be honest about our own problems, too. When you list the powers that be, there's also the problem of unions who have been raising this or thinking about how unions would have to change themselves to really address this. And we have to admit that the state is a problem. It's a capitalist state. It's developed the capacities to run a capitalist economy, to control labor, to manage discontent. It hasn't developed capacities for planning. So what we're talking about when we raise this is a transformation of the state. It's about actually developing the capacities to not only plan, but to plan democratically. And we should be honest about, yeah, it's hard. But the reality is that the market is failing in terms of the promise of giving people rich lives in every sense of the word. And we have to think about, security as an important value. We have to think about equality. Those are all things that the market fails in. It's failing in the environment. It's failing in equality. It's failing in security. It's failing in terms of a rich personal life. So what economists consider exceptions, those are actually what's most important, and that's what the market is failing. So we have to be honest about it. It's not going to be easy to change. It is going to be hard. We'll go through some tough times, and we have to say, well, we accept it because the other road is a dead-end street. The thing about change is we have to develop not just the ideas and the policies on paper, but we have to build the working class into the kind of social force that's confident about its standing for what's good and what's right and being able to challenge business hegemony. And I think business is very vulnerable now.
Sam, let me challenge you, though, on one of your points. You pointed out we don't have the capacity now for that planning. The state is completely captured by capital and sort of tries to manage it in some ways, supporting corporate power. We have examples, though, of mass conversion. The example often cited is, of course, World War II, but there are other examples later than that in the world, the way Japan industrialized and Korea and various other places. There was a huge amount of planning, although on capitalist terms, but by the state. It seems to me we can look to that period when it became necessary to do planning, when there was a threat that couldn't be met by private capital. The U.S. state, at least, stepped in. It's on the Roosevelt period, the New Deal. Of course, it was World War II that really led to the mobilization and got us out of the Depression. Well, this is going to be like World War II, it seems to me, what we're facing. People are going to recognize the enormous threat to climate change. Hopefully it's not too late when they recognize it, but there will become a point when great crisis, food prices spiking, great cities underwater, unable to produce anything, people scrambling to stay alive, in the countryside as well. Many great areas of the world are going to be triaged. Transportation will be stopped. It seems to me that's sort of likely in our future, say the climate scientists. A little bit before that point, if we're lucky, it seems to me that we could get a majority of people saying we have to change things. Things have to change radically. If we're really smart about it, now we can start doing that planning and create models of cities like Oshawa and Toronto that would provide models for the entire reconstruction of the economy and society that will be necessary.
Well, I'm very sympathetic, and I've used the example of the war myself because it shows the potential to do things. There's a potential to convert, technically. I mean, what the war shows that in 1945 we could actually convert it. From a technical perspective, it's possible. But the question is the social take on this. I mean, one of the things that happened during the wartime was that a lot of businessmen went in and did a lot of the planning. And part of the outcome of that was that rather than developing the capacities of the state to plan, as soon as these businessmen left, that capacity wasn't there. And I think they misunderstood that. They didn't want that kind of autonomous capacity for the state. So I want to emphasize a couple of things. One is that it's not just that the state is captured by business and we should capture it. It's that the state has developed historically for decades and decades. It has certain capacities for certain kinds of planning, but it doesn't have the kind of capacities for overall planning of a whole economy in normal times. I'm talking about even if you took over, and you're going to see this as a permanent kind of a planning to deal with the environment, not just a temporary. And it doesn't have the capacity to figure out how to really do it democratically. I'm just saying that we see the potentials in particular examples. We see the potentials in the war. They're very important. You're absolutely right to raise them. But we also have to recognize that this is still part of developing. It's developing our way of thinking and doing and organizing and conducting political activity, but also of transforming the state so that you can really do these things. We shouldn't underestimate how difficult it would be. It can sound scary and overwhelming. We just have to see it as it's absolutely necessary, exactly in terms of that you described, and we have to figure out how to do it. You know, we have to have some faith that as human beings, if we remove some of these barriers of capitalism, we can do it.
That was Bill Resnick and Sam Jindin talking about UAW, United Auto Workers in Canada, and the closing of the General Motors plant in Oshawa. It was an industrial suburb of Toronto. We'll air the second part of their conversation on next week's Old Mole. They've been talking about retooling the auto industry and the industrial parks in Oshawa in particular to combat climate change and to produce what the public and not capital needs. After this musical break, we'll return to hear Larry Bolden review Kirstie Manning's new novel, The Song of the Jade Lily. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Portland-based folk indie band Akron Family singing the title track from their second album, Meek Warrior. It's a reference to the concept in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition of warriorship. And up next, we're going to be hearing from Ronald Purser, who wrote the book McMindfulness. Ronald Purser, the connection with the song, got some of his initial Buddhist trainings in a Tibetan Buddhist tradition from the Nyingma Institute. We're going to hear a poem by Jack Kerouac, and then we will turn to that interview.
I can see the blank wall. I can see the silhouette in the window. He's talking. I'm not interested in what he's talking about. I'm only interested in the fact that it's the last hotel. The last hotel. Ghosts in my bed. The goats are bled. The last hotel. Signs on the sheen of this skin, the sheath of proud self cracks, the sword rusts, the swordsman falls sighing in the fault sour sea. The world and everything in it, one vast body seen and hassled by sentient embodied thinking, bearers of mind, which is the manifestation of the tranquil and eternal radiant bright essence, mind of perfect purity, beyond all body, neither light nor eyes alone reveal. Moveless mind sees motion, yin, shape, shadow, clock. Changeless mind sees change. Reflections, particles of dust. Oh, it's a return to the original mind. Return those shoes to the shoemaker. Return this hand to my father. this pillow to the pillow maker, those slippers to the shop, and that wainscot to the carpenter. But my mind, my tranquil and eternal mind, return it to whom?
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. We switched things up today because we had some traffic snarls affect who's going on when. So we're going to turn to my interview with Ronald Purser, author of McMindfulness. What we had just heard, if you did not know, is Jack Kerouac himself reading his poem, The Last Hotel. He recorded a number of sessions like that back in the 50s. And he, you know, signifies a important beginning point of modern mindfulness, modern Buddhism, and the attempt to draw from these traditions some way of dealing with the anomie and the other unpleasantness of modern life. Ronald Purser is a professor of management at San Francisco State University. His essays and cultural criticism have appeared in the Huffington Post, Salon, Alternate, and Tricycle magazine. Beyond McMindfulness, which he co-authored with David Loy for the Huffington Post in 2013, led to his book McMindfulness, How Mindfulness Became the New Capitalist Spirituality, which we're going to talk about today. Dr. Purser began his Buddhist training in 1981 at the Tibetan Nyingma Institute in Berkeley, California, and is also an ordained Buddhist teacher in the Korean Zen Taigo Order. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Ron.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So your book, McMindfulness, is a fascinating interrogation of the development of mindfulness practice in the Western context. You wrote this essay about 6.5 years ago that was kind of what spearheaded this, and then over the next several years it developed into this book. What prompted you to write that essay, and what brought you to developing it into this book?
Yes, it was just about that time that corporate mindfulness programs were being offered in places like Google in Silicon Valley. I live in San Francisco, so I started taking notice of these. And I started to feel that there was some ethical issues in how these programs were being deployed as basically productivity enhancement techniques. I teamed up with David Loy, as you mentioned, who is a pioneer in what's called socially engaged Buddhism. And we wrote that article, and to our surprise, it went viral and caused quite a stir and a lot of debates in both the mindfulness and Buddhist communities. Over time, I kept tabs on how the so-called mindfulness movement made its way into other sectors, such as public schools, government, U.S. military. But I was somewhat ignorant of other critiques that had a lot of relevance to what was going on in the mindfulness movement. I had not read people like Henri Giraud, who is a critical educational theorist, Michel Foucault's work, and many others. I wasn't even familiar with how neoliberalism was a pervasive social philosophy that had impacts on our sense of identity. And so that sort of led me to put together this book as more of a comprehensive critique of mindfulness in the Western world.
And it also, from what I can tell, inspired you to start a blog of your own called The Mindful Cranks, where you've explored some of these issues in episode-by-episode depth. Could you tell us a bit about that and how it's been a part of this project?
Yeah, the podcast, it's called The Mindful Cranks. It's kind of a funny story because one of my detractors, someone who I've debated on Facebook, who is a proponent of secular mindfulness, called me a crank. So I appropriated that term and decided that to create a podcast to invite more scholars and teachers and practitioners that had more of a critical perspective on mindfulness, and that led to the podcast. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just give you an overview of what I mean by that. When I use the term mindfulness, there's several layers of what the critique is kind of encompassing. First is that if we look at secular forms of mindfulness, they've been decoupled from a moral and ethical context and commodified into a set of instrumental techniques. which then can be recontextualized or deployed for some very dubious applications and uses. Secondly, these practices, the way that they're being presented, can be used for more self-serving and ego-enhancing purposes. So these applications basically are presented as ways to reduce stress of the private individual. But by doing so, it's framed within a biological or biomedical paradigm. So these programs basically psychologize and medicalize stress and other social problems. They put a great deal of emphasis on self-regulation, personal control over emotions, but by placing the burden on individuals to accommodate and adapt to the status quo. So this kind of focus on self-regulation, it kind of induces a way of self-discipline. It's kind of a disciplinary form of power where there's an obsessive self-monitoring of one's own inner states. And what it does is it kind of induces a social myopia, and it's displaced by a turning inward, like the inward turn. We're kind of provoked to endlessly work on ourselves, kind of endlessly work on self-improvement. And that creates a massive blind spot to the more political, economic, and cultural context that is, in many respects, causing the sort of distress due to systemic and structural issues. So this privatized view of stress, which mindfulness sort of produces, it basically sends a message that our stress and anxiety is all inside our own heads. I find that very problematic. And if we take a step back, you know, McMindfulness also signals that this is a huge capitalist industry. It's now valued at $1.5 billion. And basically, they're selling us back these individualistic, commodified cures to reduce the stress that we're feeling, which, again, the diagnosis is that we're suffering from a so-called thinking disease. Somehow, our stress is nothing but a problem of maladaptation to the environment. And so that's why I call it a capitalist spirituality, highly individualistic, accommodated to predominant Western capitalist society. And that's how it's become easily co-opted. And it kind of suffers from this accommodationist orientation, which pacifies our feelings of anxiety at the individual level and then takes the ball off of the larger social and structural and political issues and inequalities that are at the root of a lot of social suffering and distress. So it promotes these salutary health benefits, but at the same time, it does so by becoming easily assimilated into existing systems. And it's presented as a salvific force that can then help us cope with noxious influences of capitalism. So McMindfulness is all about how mindfulness has become subordinated to the economic realm and taken over by market forces. It appeals to consumer-based seeker of spirituality. It's like the Wild West out there now. We have a spiritual, they're making all sorts of exaggerated claims. The genie's got out of the bottle, so to speak, and it's become like a panacea or cure-all. And that's kind of, I think, sums up, I think, the nature of McMindfulness.
And so how is it different, or is it really that different from other sorts of ideological palliatives? There's positive psychology, even, you know, yoga has been kind of accused of being this colonized and appropriated kind of technology of spiritual and physical renewal that is just making it easier for us to adjust to a sick society.
Yeah, I think there's a family resemblance, and I think they're all under the same umbrella, so to speak. The happiness industry, as you mentioned, positive psychology, the focus on creating resilience in employees and individuals. Now there's a new one out there called grit. You just have to have the right amount of grit to be successful. They all sort of adhere to this bootstrapping notion that by turning inward, we can tap into our inner resources and pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, no matter what our economic or social conditions are. And so, yeah, I think there's definitely a similarity of these wellness techniques.
Now, is the focus on individuality something that you think is very new, or is there a historical precedent for there being a tension between the individual and them doing what they can with that's within their control about their own suffering versus the wider world that actually constitutes each and every individual?
Individualism has been around for a long time in American society, kind of our national character and the wild, wild west, the rugged individual. But if we think of it more in terms of how neoliberalism, which is basically a complex cultural hegemony, basically an insidious worldview that we're individuals, as entrepreneurs, we're running our own enterprises, you know. So this ideology is that really we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We're basically economic actors in competition with others. And I think it's this really radical atomization, which has become exacerbated in many ways. And this is how I call it neoliberal mindfulness, because it plays on this rhetoric that happiness is just a skill. It's like going to the gym where you can work out. It's very individualistic. It's cut off from any sort of notion of community, the need for a safety net. Everything is sort of seen as the self-governance of free and autonomous individuals that need to self-regulate, to take responsibility for their own self-care. And in order to be employable, in order to thrive in a precarious economy. So it's this characterization of mindfulness as turning inward to a private, interior, inner subjectivity, where we can have this kind of unfettered sense of agency. All can be carried out in isolation from the wider social, political, and economic structures. And this is what Michel Foucault called this the neoliberal turn. And he talked about a concept he called governmentality. And government is not just a political activity, but it's really how power relations function through our subjectivity. And so I'm drawing on his critique in a way, and trying to expose how institutions are shaping and regulating and informing behaviors and attitudes and our affective life. So this is a way of understanding how neoliberalism operates at these micro levels of power and kind of reformulates and reshapes what it means to be a person, our sense of self and identity. So, like you mentioned, the self-help movement, this whole self-help genre, which mindfulness is part of, it valorizes this idea of individual autonomy, freedom, choice, authenticity. These are all the things you hear in the rhetoric of the mindfulness movement. It's the ideology of autonomy, which penetrates deep into our psyche. But it kind of presents it as this is a expansion of our personal freedom. One of the key problems with this is that our personal troubles, our anxieties, our insecurities, our worries, are never connected. They're never attributed to political and socioeconomic conditions. They're always framed as psychological or individualized personal pathologies. And so we're led to believe that the way to reform society is through therapy or through these individualized interventions. And that's, I think, just part of the problem.
I guess what I'm trying to bring it back to is the Buddhist context, the original cultural context of mindfulness, and whether that has anything to offer in terms of showing how mindfulness could actually be connected to a transformation of society. Because on my research, the Buddhist tradition doesn't have a lot of things to say about the order of the world, that promulgating the Buddhist practice will transform individuals, and then individuals will be the ones who actually make the world better. And I'm wondering whether there is something within the Buddhist tradition that has to be confronted. I know in your book, you talk, and in some of your podcast interviews, you talk about how, you know, Buddhism and mindfulness isn't just about, you know, the present moment and this domination of our attention with the present moment, but that it actually involves a lot of thinking and a lot of risk-taking in terms of thinking things through. And I'm wondering whether there are things in the Buddhist tradition that the global situation today is calling on us to think through in terms of the causes and conditions of social and individual suffering, and how it's going to take social mass movements to actually end many types of suffering that the individual can't.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've been thinking a lot about that. Well, first of all, when we say Buddhism, there is no one Buddhism. It isn't monolithic. So we have to be careful when we use the term Buddhism. But I think in general, you're absolutely right that if we try to look back to earlier traditional Buddhism, we're not going to get a lot of answers about social and political transformation. So traditional Buddhism, it does view the causes in the realm of suffering. They often refer to these as the three root poisons: greed, ill will, and delusion. Traditional Buddhism locates those poisons, the roots of suffering, within our own individual mind streams. But I think we need to understand the historical context better for these teachings, which go back over two millennia. Basically, these were monastics and renunciants who lived in very small communities. These monastics took voluntary vows of poverty, but they were taken care of, clothing, shelter. They were taken care of either by lay devotees or by royal patronage. So they weren't starving, and in that respect, they could afford to be apolitical. And they relied, as I mentioned, on royal patronage. So in a way, the Buddha's early teachings were focused on the liberation of human consciousness. But on the other hand, the Buddhist teachings, his early teachings, were often directed to political rulers, and he offered many teachings to that effect. But you won't see any sort of systemic structural analysis of society or any attempt for social revolution in the Buddhist traditions. So I think we are now at a point where we're reinventing Buddhism as we go along, because we're translating. We're in the process of a cultural translation of Buddhism in the Western world, which has not been going on that long, maybe 100, 250 years. I think the problem is that it's landed in medicine, and it's landed in psychology, which have given Buddhism a tremendous sort of cultural legitimacy, because it's appealed to this kind of Western rationalist scientific paradigm. The downside of that is that it's limited our understanding transformation, like the transformation of consciousness, for example, to focus on individual salvation. So both, I think, modern mindfulness and early Buddhism were limited in this respect to a focus on individual salvation, and they really didn't have the tools or the impetus to bring that into the social and public sphere. But that's not to say that we couldn't take some of the essential, you could say, radical processes of liberation and extend that into the more social and public sphere. So I think that it's interesting. The Dalai Lama, for example, announced, I think back 5 or 6 years ago, that he was a Marxist. In fact, he said he was half Marxist and half Buddhist. So I think there is compatibility of taking modern Buddhism and having a dialectical relationship with social and political thought. That's just beginning to happen.
Do you think that the ethical moral foundation or framework for mindfulness practice that would be more liberatory could be found in modern movements for social justice, for reshaping the world in more democratic means through labor unions, through parties, through community assemblies? Could that become a framework, or is there something about the very specific way, the historical way that the teachings and the ethical priorities of traditional Buddhism are tied to what's liberating about mindfulness and other meditation?
That's a good question. As I mentioned in the book, in order to do that, to liberate mindfulness, so to speak, we have to really turn critique outwards. And what I mean by that is towards our social and political institutions, as well as the systems of power that are interlinked, that have exacerbated the suffering and collective stress. So in a way, we have to decolonize mindfulness and find ways to sever its ties to the marketplace if we're going to actually do that. And I think that requires a new praxis that facilitates critical reflection on the causes of our collective suffering, what David Loewe calls social dukkha. Dukkha is a term in the Buddhist tradition of suffering. So as he points out, these three mental poisons, which are usually seen as restricted and located within the individual, greed, ill will, and delusion, they're no longer limited to being seen as just interior afflictions. Rather, these mental poisons have become institutionalized and proliferated in our society, whether it's in the media, politics, economy. I think we need new theoretical resources and new explanatory narratives that can help expand beyond the boundaries of the biomedical paradigm, because that's where mindfulness has been situated. That has a very restrictive individual level focus. Also, suffering has been dehistoricized and privatized, and you know, this whole focus on blaming the victim, we have to kind of get away from that and see how our suffering is linked to social, economic, and political context, and help find ways through new practices that restore insight into seeing the linkages, the complex linkages of how power and privilege, for example, even among mindfulness teachers, has resulted in complicity and collusion with the status quo and with corporations, for example. So this is where we can draw inspiration from people like Henry Giroux, where we can have mindfulness programs that bring in critical pedagogies that reorient practices towards examining the conditions of social suffering, oppression, collective experiences of trauma, systemic racism, other forms of marginalization. And it cannot all be reduced to the psychological and to the individual. So I think it's important that the Buddhist view actually rejects the individual as the primary unitary reality. This is some of the radical teachings, for example, is that the teachings on no self or anatta, that the individual is really a process that is inseparable from other processes. So that means the whole ideology underpinning the contemporary neoliberal conception of the human needs to be displaced in some ways by this wider vision of how our suffering is interdependent. There has to be much more emphasis on interdependence. If you think of the term compassion, which is often used quite a bit in Buddhist circles, it really means suffering with others, or co-suffering, you could say. So this is kind of the movement towards a more socially engaged mindfulness or more socially engaged Buddhism, where we can come up with new practices that confront and really call into question these oppressive social institutions that are often the cause of suffering. And so I think that's the direction I'd like to see, the how we can kind of take back this movement away from its capitalist stranglehold.
Thank you, Ronald Purser, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about McMindfulness, how mindfulness became the new capitalist spirituality.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Bhagavate Vaisajya Guru Vaidurya Prabharajaya Tathagataya Arhatte Samyak Sambuddhaya Tanyata Vaisajya Vaisajya Mahavaisajya Sammugate Svaha.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was the Medicine Buddha Mantra set to banjo and guitar in Reedsport, Oregon by Reverend Hing Shur and Fabiatko. Before that, I was talking with Ronald Purser about the topic of mindfulness in modern society. To finish today's show, Larry Bolden is going to be reviewing Kirsty Manning's new novel, The Song of the Jade Lily.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a very complex and beautiful novel, The Song of the Jade Lily by Kirsty Manning. This long and beautifully constructed novel bounces back and forth between Vienna in the late 30s and early 40s, Melbourne, 2016, and Shanghai, also in the late 30s and 40s. It is a story of a friendship between a beautiful Shanghai girl, Li, and a Jewish refugee, Rami. They meet in Shanghai in 1939. The two become instant best friends who explore densely populated Shanghai, which they call the Paris of the East. While author Manning insisted it is a work of fiction, it is nevertheless a well-researched historical novel. As she explains in the author's notes, Shanghai had opened its doors to more than 20,000 refugees fleeing Europe at a time when no other country would. Close quote. The story begins in Vienna as Romy, 12, is literally dragged along by her parents through a scene of chaos, smoke and flying glass everywhere as the Jewish ghetto is razed in what would come to be known as Kristallnacht. Both of Romy's brothers are dragged off by Nazi soldiers, only one of whom lives long enough to be sent to a concentration camp. Without telling too much of the novel, suffice it to say that Romy and her father eventually escape Vienna by fleeing first to Italy, which was not yet conjoined with Germany, and then by boat to Shanghai. Romy's father is a doctor and soon finds employment in the Jewish hospital in Shanghai, and Romy begins her exciting relationship with Li. The third strand of the story takes the reader to Melbourne in 2016. Alexandra, the granddaughter of Romy, has recently left London and a relationship she thought would culminate in marriage and rushes to Melbourne to be with her dying grandpa, Wilhelm, and her grandmother, Romy. The author takes the reader through the four sections or concessions of Shanghai: the international concession, the ghetto where Jews are permitted to live and work, the zone controlled by the Japanese, and the French concession full of luxury hotels and shops. Manning takes the time to describe in detail the huge variety of food and flowers to be seen there. Knowing so very little of Shanghai and nothing of its tolerance of Jewish refugees during the war, I was stunned by the description of this magical city. The character of Li, while fictional, is based on a very famous Shanghai singer. Li lives in a luxurious hotel in the international section that she and Romy come to know in great detail. Theirs is one of the several close friendships between female characters in the book. Another is that between Romy and Nina, both Jewish refugees who end up in Melbourne. Alexandra wants to learn of the histories of her grandparents, and after the death of Wilhelm, her grandfather, she goes to Shanghai and begins her search to uncover their stories. Again from the author's notes, "While I was writing a story about refugees and how China opened their doors and hearts to the Jews, Australia was locking up refugees who attempted to come there by boat. Why haven't the lessons of history taught us to treat people better?" Close quote. Besides introducing me to Shanghai and its treatment of Jews during World War II, the author also discovers many other interesting bits of war history. Again, quoting from her notes, "I also discovered that before 1940, it was possible to be released from a concentration camp if you had a valid passport, visa, permit to take up residency in another country, and proof of transport. Such release was always subject to the prisoner leaving Germany within a limited time. The time frame and the documents needed varied from case to case." Close quote. As you read this lovely, if often frightening, book, I think you might begin to hear echoes of the song of the Jade Lily, almost able to see the beautiful Lee as she sang for her enthralled audiences. It is obvious that the author has been captured by the sights and sounds of Shanghai, and she manages to give her readers a window into that world. One strand of the novel I have not touched on is that of the relationship between traditional Chinese medicine and mainstream medicine. Both Romy and her mother had a keen interest in Chinese medicine, as does author Manning, seeing them as adjuncts rather than opposites. I've been talking about Kirsty Manning's 2019 novel, The Song of the Jade Lily. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Prabharajaya Tathagataya Arhatte Samyak Sam.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Again, that's the Medicine Master Buddha Mantra. That's it for today's Old Mole. Thank you to our guests, Bill Resnick and Sam Jindin. Bill and Resnick and Sam Jindin will be talking again next week. They'll be continuing their conversation about UAW and the potential to actually retool our industrial economy rather than just shut everything down and tear it apart and sell it for metal. Thanks to Ronald Purser for talking with me about his new book, McMindfulness, how mindfulness became the new capitalist spirituality. And thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of Kirsty Manning's The Song of the Jade Lily. You can find The Old Mole in its entirety or as segments by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. We'll get this show posted within a couple days, and you can listen to many years back worth of shows and share them too. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter by looking us up that way. And if you would like to send us questions, comments, or get involved with the Old Mole, please, please, please email us, oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Up next, we're going to hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. She's going to be talking with Eric DePlace of the Sightline Institute about this year and last year. Bhagavate Vaisajaguru.